The process of maturation that happens in Buddhist practice, the path that gets developed as we cultivate Buddhism, is a process which is supported by happiness, that is nourished by happiness. And as happiness becomes stronger for a person, as happiness is appreciated and cultivated and tuned into, that in return becomes a condition that supports and develops the path further. And I know sometimes people will get kind of grim with practice and too serious about it, and will forget that that happiness kind of needs to be there. Now, often in people's lives, the reason they come to practice is because they're unhappy. And so then it's a little bit of a paradox to be told we have to be happy first. And But you don't have to be happy first. And there's certainly, you know, Buddha's practice, you know, is a practice to be where you're at. But as a practice develops and over the months and years, it's important to begin appreciating the role that happiness has. And to let happiness be something you drink in, that nourishes you. In the ancient texts, they talk, mature practitioners talked about drinking the joy of the Dharma. Something you drink, you know, take in, you, it supports you. And there is a particular kind of happiness. There's many kinds of happinesses, but there's a particular kind of happiness which is part of this support system for practice. And it's the happiness of contentment. And so I'd like to talk about contentment some more. I talked about it some Monday night. I'd like to continue talking about it. There is a famous quote by the Buddha where he says that the greatest wealth is happiness, is contentment. And so better than any other form of wealth, contentment is the greatest wealth. To bring the kind of home to America, a similar kind of quote maybe is by Benjamin Franklin, where he said, "Discontent makes a rich man poor, and contentment makes a poor man rich." And in fact, one of the richest people I know in my life is someone who's actually quite poor, and is completely content, very happy, and lives kind of exuberantly. And the fact that he's quite poor doesn't seem to... I don't know if it's maybe never occurred to him that he's poor. And then when I talked about contentment last Monday, at the end of the talk, there was time for questions, and someone asks a very appropriate question, and often a very common question when someone talks about contentment, and that is, how can we be content in a world where there's so much injustice, a world where there's so much suffering and difficulties? And doesn't that lend itself to a certain kind of complacency? Just, you know, I'll just accept the fact, you know, what you can fill in the blank, but all kinds of things which shouldn't be accepted. And I think it's a very common question because we have a strong tendency to think kind of in absolutes. If someone talks about contentment, it seems like that's the, you know, everything is referred to in the filter of that idea of contentment. But contentment is just one aspect of a human being. And the human being is multidimensional. There's many different aspects that are developed and cultivated and that function together. And contentment is a very important aspect of us, but there are other things that go along parallel with contentment in human life. And later in the talk, I'd like to suggest that there's a place for a healthy form of discontent that can coexist with contentment. And it's not one or the other, but it's kind of finding out where the healthy aspect of both are, and then cultivating the healthy aspect of both, so they both operate. Contentment doesn't mean we become passive, but rather it means that when we engage in our activities in the world, It's based on being content in the first place, having some level of contentment that supports our activity and our actions. In the Buddhist tradition, as I think is true for many different spiritual traditions, contentment is considered a very important virtue. And the place that's most clearly seen is in one of the first instructions to Buddhists to become monastics, monks and nuns. And that is that they're expected to cultivate a life of contentment. And in particular, a life of contentment with their clothes, with their lodgings, with their food, and sometimes it said contentment with the medicines that they're allowed to have. There's certain prescribed medicines they're allowed to use. And someone who is a monastic learns to be content with the clothes they have. And usually they have very few clothes, just maybe a couple of sets of robes, sometimes just one set of robes that they wear. And both sets of robes are basically the same. You know, it's not like they can change their wardrobe from one day to the next. It's the same kind of outfit. And this kind of contentment with just having just one or two sets of robes is likened in the sutra to the kind of to give a person the kind of freedom that a bird has. It said in the text that a bird is burdened only by his or her wings, and otherwise is free to soar and to fly. And so there's kind of a lightness of being. And imagine a bird that has luggage. You know, several suitcases and carry-on luggage, and you know, the bird's not going to go anywhere. The bird is free to fly so beautifully. It inspires many people that you have a soaring bird because it has nothing to weighs it down. So the monastic can travel quite freely because of having these very few possessions. And it doesn't take a lot of reflection to probably for most of us to reflect back in our life. Maybe we have to go far back. I don't know how it is for any of you. To think of times when you had some certain level of discontent with your clothes that you have. Gee, I've been wearing the same kind of clothes for you know, 3 days now, or 2 days, or you know, I can't wear that clothes again, that shirt again, because I wore it last week, and the same people are going to be there. I have to have something a little more exciting or different, you know. There's all kinds of ways in which we feel a certain level of discontent. Discontent is kind of an umbrella word for a lot of different attitudes that we have in our lives. Envy and greed and insecurity and jealousy and aversion. All kinds of could perhaps be fit under this kind of word, discontent. So to think back, you know, when is it that you felt discontent around the clothes that you have? And what is it that discontent represents? What is it that, because it isn't just simply clothes itself, probably the clothes represent something for you. And when you look at what it represents for you, then what does it say about what your understanding is of being a human being, or what you feel like you need in order to be a successful human being, or to get along in life? And perhaps you think that, for example, that you need to be admired a certain way by the clothes that you wear. And so, you know, it's very important then to wear clothes that kind of show a certain kind of status in society. So for me, for example, it might be that I should get a suit and tie. And then you'd really see, you know, my stature as a Dharma teacher. You know, you know, that'd really be, you know, somewhat important. So the look at the discontent is a very important part of practice, and to understand what's being represented there, what are some of the things that are going on that trigger us to feel discontent. A very interesting distinction to look at in practice is the distinction between what happens to us and what we do. And discontent and contentment is something that we add to a situation. It's never inherent in the situation itself, but rather it's something that we do. And do we take then responsibility for what we do in any given situation? And I think Buddhist practice very much involves taking some responsibility for our contribution to the situation. And the suggestion, the challenge I have here today is that contentment and discontent is our contribution, is something that we do. And we should never take it as being something inherent with the situation, that I feel discontent because the situation's at fault. Situations can be terrible. You can be quite poor and feel a deep level of contentment in life. The poverty doesn't have to be a source of discontent, though it can also be a source of discontent. But that's your choice. It's something going on inside of you. So what is that? And so part of what we do in mindfulness practice is to stop and look at discontent, to be very honest about it, and try to tease apart what is really going on here. To be, in a sense, intolerant of our discontent, so that we really stop and look at it very honestly and not be propelled by it. There's a way in which discontent can propel us forward out of ourselves, out of the moment, out of looking at ourselves, into the future, into the world around us, and kind of blind ourselves from the place where practice can most deeply occur, which is in that place where we're making our choices or how we are. So part of practice then is to stop and look, okay, I'm feeling discontent here. And what is going on here? What does this represent? What are the values? What are the understandings that I have that are operating? What's the emotions that are operating? What's the attachments that are operating here? And to understand that. So something as simple as our clothes is some place where you can explore a lot of different things. The other form of contentment that a monastic cultivates is contentment with the food. And monastics live a somewhat Spartan life. It's not meant to be an ascetic life, but they are not supposed to eat after 12 o'clock noon. And some monks will only eat one meal a day, some two meals a day before 12 o'clock. And then they give up their food. They give away any food that they have, so that the next day they are completely dependent on the food that's offered to them as a donation from people who want to feed them. And then they're expected to cultivate contentment with whatever is given. And they look at their bowl and say, oh, gee, you know, not rice again. and this is what's happened. This is what I'm being given. And be content with that level of whatever it is. And there's a lot of stories in monastics in Asia of going long periods of time in very poor districts and given very meager fare, rice that has been cooked with flies that flew into it, or endless sticky rice, and no vegetables hardly at all, maybe a little bit of sauce to go with it. And to cultivate contentment with that. Or maybe some days not get any food at all because maybe there was no one to give them any food that day. And what is it to be content with not even getting any food at all? To have the capacity to fast, the capacity to go with days without food if necessary. You're not expected to starve to death, but not to be driven by food and neurotic around food is part of what monastics cultivate. And it doesn't take a lot of reflection in our society to see that there's not a lot of neurosis in America around food. And so people, Americans who become monastics, then they're expected to look at that neurosis and work with it and kind of purify it or free themselves of it rather than just take it for granted and let it continue to drive their lives. And then monastics are expected to cultivate contentment with their lodgings and whatever they're given. And often it could be quite Spartan. You know, they're just given a small little room, 5x8 or something, just a teeny room, so they just has a bed in it, or sometimes larger, and whatever it might be that they're... or maybe having no lodging at all, just sleeping under a tree. Sometimes in Thailand they have this wonderful umbrellas that the monastics carry with them when they go on tours. I think it's called a gork. And it's kind of a little bit oversized umbrella. And it's the same color as the robes. And it has this mosquito netting that kind of hangs over it and comes down. And so they can see, there's insects and stuff at night. So they can sit and meditate under a tree, and they hang as a hook on top of the umbrella, and they hook it over the branch. And then they sit underneath that umbrella. And if it rains, then the umbrella keeps them dry. And if the mosquitoes come out, the netting keeps them free of mosquitoes. And the netting is big enough so that they can lay down and sleep if they need to. Though then I don't think it would keep them from the rain. So they kind of have to keep meditating when it rains. And again, in the context of the ancient Indian tradition, this is not meant to be ascetic. The Buddha's instructions around monastics or the way he set up the monastic order, is to provide them with just enough of their necessities for life so that they're comfortable, so that they can focus on practice. So we don't need to interpret that for ourselves, that we're supposed to kind of, you know, live with a gork, you know, and just hang it around over a tree and, you know, just wait for someone to offer us food before we eat. But rather, it's kind of a challenge to us who are lay people to look, what's the difference between that level of living which supports our life and lets it, you know, and that which is extra maybe gets in the way, like having luggage for the bird, that gets in the way of doing something we think maybe is quite important. I think anytime someone's involved in spiritual practice, there is an evaluation that goes on between what is it that really supports that practice and allows a person to engage in it wholeheartedly, and what is it that gets in the way of that. And it isn't that what gets in the way is wrong or bad, but you have to make some choices. And just like now we're kind of having the Olympics soon, an Olympic athlete makes the same choices. What is it that supports developing that skill or that sport, and what gets in the way? So living a life of contentment with just enough to support our life in a healthy way is supportive of a spiritual life. The Buddha said that the Dharma grows for a person on contentment, with contentment. The Buddha also said that monastics should cultivate contentment, and they should talk about contentment. It's part of their instructions, what they're supposed to kind of go around the world talking about. So I'm not a monk now, but I'm following these ancient instructions. But this is one of the things you're supposed to talk about, is contentment. So hopefully you're content hearing this. Now, contentment, I think of, you know, there's many different kinds of contentment. And perhaps we can point to a simple physical one, biological one first, as a kind of stepping stone to understanding it in other areas of our lives. And that is, you know, simple contentment with having eaten. I hope that all of you have had the experience of having eaten to a point of being content. And perhaps you even said to someone, someone's offered you seconds or thirds or something or fourths or something. And you say, you know, I really would like that, but, you know, I'm actually quite content. And the feeling of contentment has a kind of happiness to it, or joy or satisfaction, that's quite wonderful. And maybe some of you occasionally have taken that extra step, eaten a little bit more, and you've lost the contentment because, oh, how can I have eaten so much, you know? And you feel kind of heavy and lethargic, and why didn't I stop when I, you know, it was going well? And so occasionally it can be really a wonderful feeling to feel kind of content with how much you've eaten. It's kind of a certain kind of lightness or joy or ease in the body. I don't know how each of you might feel it, but to feel kind of physical contentment of eating. Or physical contentment with getting enough exercise. Get just the right amount of exercise. You can get too much and not have it. You feel exhausted. But you can feel kind of vitalized in a wonderful way and feel a certain contentment. You know, when I eat, for example, when I eat, I tend to listen to my body, because my mind has desires. Yeah, that looks really great. And so I've trained myself to kind of pay attention to my body. And my body will often tell me, if my body feels content, it often, you know, I feel that, and I rest there. And then I won't listen to the mind. You know, let the mind kind of do what it's thinking. Oh, I'd really like that. And it's okay, you know. So So there's physical contentment. And then there's, you know, other kinds of contentment. There's kind of unhealthy kinds of contentment. You know, when some person at work that you really dislike gets a demotion, and you feel, wow, I feel really content. That's really right, you know. That kind of happiness or satisfaction with how things are, which is a definition of contentment. I'm really happy this guy got a demotion. That's really, I don't know, that's what's meant by contentment. But then there can be, you know, the kind of contentment with your accomplishments or other people's accomplishments. I mean, there's a wonderful sense of contentment that can come. You can climb, you know, just go hiking and climb Windy Hill. I've never climbed a mountain like that, a hill like that, and you get to the top and, wow, I did it. It's really great. And so you feel content. And you sit at the top of Windy Hill and look out, and there's a kind of wonderful feeling of contentment that can arise, and, or other accomplishments people have made. There's an art to feeling contentment with our accomplishments, with what we've managed to do. And part of the art of it is to stop and pay attention to it, to be open to, allow oneself to feel content. I know that it's very easy to be dismissive of our own accomplishments, to feel like, you know, we're not supposed to appreciate ourselves or our own accomplishments, that's somehow a personal failing to do that. Or to feel like we're always supposed to be discontent. We're always supposed to be going further. It's never enough. This is not enough. You know, okay, I reached step one. That's not enough. I have to reach step two. Reach step two. That's not enough. I have to reach step three. And to always have kind of be driven by a certain kind of discontent or desire for more and more, as if we'll only be a successful human being if we get to a certain high level. And I know lots of people who have reached something, have spent years trying to attain something, and thinking then their life would be successful. And then find they get that, and when they have it, it feels a little bit empty perhaps. Or when they have it, that drive to have more, or that feeling of discontent is so powerful that they can't really rest there. And they're looking, oh, what's the next thing? What's the next thing? And to have a life driven by discontent is to have a life that is saturated with dissatisfaction, with a certain kind of unease. So what is it then to find ease or satisfaction, this kind of peace of contentment? And I'm suggesting that part of it is, at times, is to stop and be open to it. It's one of those things that happens when we're open to it. So where do we find it? We can find it in our accomplishments, and that's certainly a kind of contentment that we can have. But it was also found in having the right view or having a certain kind of understanding that supports contentment. Having a higher purpose for our life can give people, some people, a certain contentment in many situations. There can be very difficult, challenging situations in our life. But when we understand it from a higher perspective, a higher purpose in life, say, oh, I can put up with this because it has a higher value. Or I know how to engage in it for this higher purpose. So, for example, having screaming kids at home is very discontenting. Can you say that in English? Discontenting? I've been told you can say anything in English. That's part of the charm of the English language. You can make up words. So I think often religious people can find themselves content in many situations. There's a level of contentment because they have a higher sense of purpose that's operating at the same time. And so various distressing things can happen to them. But those distressing things is understood in a wider context. So, for example, someone might have a feeling, have a higher sense of purpose that the difficult things that happen are things which can be practiced with. And you can understand those difficulties from the point of view of practice and look at them. How can that help you refine yourselves or help you understand yourself or help liberate you? And any challenging situation, any situations that we find challenging in Buddhist practice can be invited in as a place that we can find some degree of liberation, some degree of freedom. And in a sense, the more challenged we are by our situation, the higher the possibility of freedom is in that situation. And I've seen many times when very challenging things have happened to people who are practitioners, and they've been distressed at first, but the practice is so strong, they're really engaging in that. And after a while, they're very grateful it happened, because it was composted, it was turned over in the practice for a great transformation in them. And part of the reason why the greater the challenge, the greater the spiritual possibility is that challenge is often not inherent in the situation itself. But it belongs a little bit to, again, what we're doing, what we're contributing to the situation. And when we interpret the situation as quite challenging, it's because we're adding something to the situation. So, for example, some things are challenging because they challenge our ego, our sense of identity, of who we think we need to be, our sense of self-identity. And then the stronger the self-identity, or the stronger that's being threatened, the more challenging the situation is. So then we look at that, and through practice perhaps we can realize, oh, I don't need to hold on to that self-identity. I can let go of it. And so that self-identity is let go of, and that can be quite liberating. But the challenging situation is what showed us where that attachment, particular attachment, is. So someone can be quite content in life because they have, for example, a great practice that can apply in all kinds of situations. And so a situation that normally would make the person discontent, there's a certain kind of contentment that can be there. Oh yes, this is not a good situation, but I know what to do. I have something to do here. It gives them a sense of purpose, some engagement, and this is really great. So practice can be that, sense of have a practice that applies in all kinds of situations. Some people will cultivate contentment in different situations by looking at their understanding. What is the understanding they have that gives birth to discontent in this situation? And is there a different understanding that can bring contentment? And this is where the mind, it's very helpful for the mind to be creative. Can you creatively come up with a new perspective? Rather than just giving up all your perspectives, can you come up with an interesting new perspective that can help you see the situation in a way that leads to a certain level of being at peace with the situation or being content with it? So what's an example? Can someone think of an example? Since I'm not very creative this morning. Of a creative reframing of a situation that could help you be content.
Your child is yelling and screaming, and you know, you're discontent, but then you realize that they're coming into their own and establishing a sense of self and learning to say no, and you get that bigger picture of watching your child come into a sense of themselves, and it shifts inside you.
So instead of focusing on, gee, this is stressful, and how am I going to get through this day, and am I raising a monster? you look at, oh, this is actually part of the phases and maturation maybe children go through, and they need to go through this. And my job is just to be present for it and not get caught by it. Sometimes with my oldest son, my wife would look at me and say, oh, we're having one of those days. And just that would kind of pop the bubble. You know, oh. Just one of those days. This doesn't mean it's going to be this way forever. And, you know, do any of you suffer from the disease of forever thinking? Something happens and you kind of, you don't necessarily believe it's going to be forever, but the psyche somehow kind of relates to it like, this is it. I'm always going to be depressed. This, you know, ugh. And, you know, but anyway, and things the next day, wow, what happened to that? Another example? Yes?
I took a hitchhiker many years ago with his wife. He had a very long beard. They looked like farmers. So I asked him about his life and how he got to be a farmer. This was in southern Oregon. And he said he was a stock trader on Wall Street. And he had a brand new Bentley. And he was driving on the expressway. And all of a sudden, he saw smoke pouring out of the window. And the car just came to a screeching halt. He opened the hood and blown a piston. You're looking at this $100,000 car and realize, I don't like what I do. So he walked away from the car and hitchhiked over and became a farmer. So he reframed it.
So there's a kind of healthy discontent of being discontented by things that don't make you happy and then walking away. And sometimes that's what life calls on us to do. I'm not going to put up with this. I'm going to do something different. That's appropriate at times. Another example of reframing.
Yes. Wait for the microphone.
Oh, we're going to, if you don't mind using the mic so everyone can hear.
I have a struggle with many in my family regarding politics. And the more I see them as just frightened, the easier it is for me to have compassion. So I try not to intellectualize it too much.
So to take the time to understand the other person in some depth, for example, understanding their suffering, can sometimes lead to certain peace or compassion in a situation. We're less reactive then because we understand it from a different perspective. Mirka. Maybe we can pass her the mic. Pass it down.
I remember this example in particular of someone I interviewed who has her own children and stepchildren and had a house full of children on a very rainy day, and the kids were going bonkers. And she decided to reframe the whole situation and talk with the children and say, "Isn't it wonderful, all that rain? All the trees get to drink, and all the plants get to drink, and all this." And she just reframed the whole thing as such a wonderful thing that was happening to the earth on that day, instead of looking at it as, "Oh no, I'm stuck in the house, I don't have anything to do, I can't go outside." And so all the kids changed how they were feeling about the rainy day by understanding another purpose of rain than making them miserable.
Beautiful. Thank you.
I'm a medical resident, and so I work with physicians too much, but they're notorious for not always being the most effective communicators. And so sometimes when I'm sitting in a situation where a physician is talking to a patient and it's not going so well, and I oftentimes want to sit there and go, "Oh my God, I can't believe he's talking to them like that." But instead I'll say, "Oh, this is how I should not communicate."
Thank you. Jen, this can be the last one.
Well, for me, being aware of the things, terrible things that are going on in the world that we read about every day, really helps me to see that my life, and probably most of the people in here most of the time, have a very easy and safe life, and it could be so much worse. And most of the things that happen are really small compared to so many other things that are happening.
I've read people who have given advice that one of the ways to cultivate contentment is to compare yourself to people who have it worse off. I don't know if that's always a wise thing to do, but sometimes some certain kind of compare, like your comparison you're making, certain things kind of pale in importance when we realize, how other people are living their lives. Yes?
I have two questions. It's like I'm getting a feeling of gratitude versus contentment with some of these.
Especially the last one, it seems like gratitude is more like the feeling that you're great, you're kind of, you know, so I'm feeling a connection of gratitude with contentment. And how does contentment and equanimity, you know, it's sort of like very close and necessary.
Yes.
And does that contentment connect with equanimity? Does that foster contentment, equanimity, or is there, what's the connection there?
I think that the connection goes in both directions, that contentment fosters equanimity and equanimity fosters contentment. But equanimity can doesn't have to have a subject. It's just a kind of a state. Contentment can be that way also, but usually contentment has a subject, that we're happy or satisfied with the situation as it is. So we kind of let things be. So it has a little bit more of a subject, something we're relating to. And gratitude makes a lot of sense. I think a lot of the wholesome states of mind often can arise together and interact with each other. There's another kind of contentment which I want to mention, which is the contentment that comes from having few desires. And in a sense, Buddhist practice, as it deepens, is one that more and more understands a kind of deep peace, a deep happiness that can arise when there's few desires. And having few desires, the idea of it is can be very challenging to people. People can sometimes have a lot of reservations about relaxing or letting go of their desires. But letting go of desires is a paradoxical thing, because the motivation for acting in the world can come from a different place than where our desires come from. And the more we let go of our desires, the more the chances are for some deeper wellspring of love or inspiration to move through us. You know, the sense of mind that kind of feels a sense of lack, or heart that feels a sense of lack, will have no end to desires. But the mind which feels infinite, or the mind which feels that it has no lack at all, will still respond to the world. But it responds then more from, I think of sometimes as love, kind of something wells up inside of us and moves through us. And this is a very important distinction, the distinction between that which we believe or act on or say or think about, that in a sense, I don't have to say this, comes from the surface of who we are. And that's which we believe and understand and think and say that comes from the depth of who we are. That which is an expression of who we are versus that which is our trying to control and manipulate and do something. And part of the freedom, or part of what happens as people let go of desires and attachments and less driven by neurosis, is that our experience of life, of living, becomes an expression rather than a compensation. It's becoming our desires are an expression of who we are, our motivations are an expression of who we are, rather than an attempt to try to get something into the future, try to have something. So that contentment doesn't preclude moving towards things and trying to make things happen, but there's a feeling that it doesn't have to happen. We're all kind of coming out of an expression of being filled or feeling happy with ourselves. And in that sense of contentment, we move towards something, but it's an expression rather than a need. And a common a teaching in many spiritual traditions that leads to contentment is don't be concerned, or don't be so concerned about the results of your desires or your actions. Engage wholeheartedly with what you do. Engage with good intentions. Look at your intentions and how you do it. But then don't be so concerned with the results. And let the results take care of themselves. let some deep expression from inside of you come, and let that be enough. Sometimes I failed in situations, and in terms of some kind of the outcome, but the fact that I failed in the outcome didn't mean that I was deeply satisfied in doing it, because it was in the doing of it that was satisfying. And I feel that way with my practice sometimes. If I set up my practice from the point of view of developing concentration or getting some kind of attainment, and so I sit down for my sitting and, this sitting I'm going to attain X, or I'm going to get really concentrated, or and then I puff and I puff. And I don't have to puff, but I'm trying, to do something, and it doesn't happen. Nothing happened in that sitting. I didn't get where I was going to go. And I'm depressed for the rest of the day. Oh, I'm a failure as a practitioner. But, what I love about practice is just practicing itself. And just the fact that I'm engaged in this wonderful practice gives me a great sense of contentment in my life. And what happens because of the practice is secondary to just the wonderfulness of the practice itself. So I hope each of you will find contentment in your life. You'll understand that contentment is not a moral issue, that you're supposed to be content, but rather that contentment is something that supports you, so it allows you to do something that maybe is very important. It is a nourishment for something. It's a nourishment for you that you choose. And I wanted to offer you one practice for this week. Maybe just one. Take one day. One practice around contentment to... You can help you explore it. And there's two parts to this homework or this exercise. One is to do it. And the second is, once you've done it, is go find someone, like a friend, and talk about with that friend what happened when you did it. And if it's someone who's also doing the same exercise, that's kind of interesting, but it doesn't have to be. Just go make sure you talk to someone about what your experience has been of this exercise. And that is, take one day, and during that day, with great resolve and commitment and care and mindfulness, don't complain about anything. Oh. I know it's going to be hard. And it's kind of like, you stop having caffeine, the coffee, and there's a withdrawal period. And maybe one day is not enough to overcome the withdrawal period. Maybe you need to try this for 3 or 4 days to kind of get over it. But take one day and don't complain whatsoever. And see what you learn about yourself, and see what you might learn about contentment by not complaining about anything. Good luck. So, thank you all very much.